Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
I've actually found it extremely disappointing trying to work with this government. I said right from the beginning, since I took on this post, that mental health shouldn't be a political football. I wanted to work with the government to deliver for the people that need it the most.
And although it shouldn't always be about money, often it's the thing that governments understand. How much is it going to cost us? And actually everything we've just described there makes everything significantly cheaper.
Honestly, I feel like you're my brother from another mother with what you're saying. You really are. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Tackling the stigma.
Okay, we've got a brilliant guest on this week's Mental Health Monday. Been dying to get her on the programme for quite some time. Welcome to Mental Health Monday, Dr. Rosanna Allen Khan, Shadow Minister for Mental Health. And also, Dr. Rosanna, you're still a working doctor. You've got this dual role, which I think people will be incredibly surprised by. First and foremost, welcome. Great to get you on.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you, honestly. And I'm really excited that you're doing Mental Health Monday. I think now more than ever, it's important to be talking about our mental health, and it's great to be doing it regularly. So thanks for having me on as a guest.
Hey, absolutely. Episode 180, by the way. That's officially,
brilliant.
You're officially the bullseye. If we could throw in the darts reference. How do you make it work? The NHS is under incredible pressures and has been, you know, even before the pandemic, but, you know, we've all seen what's been going on. Plus MPs, there's been an incredible amount of scrutiny on their roles, but also the way they do their job. So what have things been like for you since March?
Well, it's been incredibly busy because Keir Starmer, the new lead at the Labour Party, appointed me into his shadow cabinet as the lead for mental health, which was a real honour. And it was a job that I really wanted and was very, very pleased to get it. And working as a practising doctor, I think it's really important to sort of say that I always put my constituents first and the people who voted me in. And when I work as a doctor, I work very irregular hours. So I will work night shifts or I will work at weekends. But I think it's so important to do that because, of course, I could have given it up if I wanted to. But I'm so grateful for the fact that I was able to go to medical school in the first place from the background that I came from. It was unheard of in my day. People from backgrounds like mine who were poor, single parent families, working class, just didn't have that opportunity. So I was determined I was going to make the most of it. And then I wasn't about to give it up and drop all my colleagues and drop the work that I loved just because I became an MP. But I was so deeply aware of the responsibility I had as an MP. I never wanted being a doctor to get in the way of that. And I think what I love the most about being an A&E doctor is that seeing the patients, meeting the patients, hearing the stories, treating them, it gives me that fire in my belly to keep on campaigning for what they need when I am in Westminster and when I am thinking about what campaigns I'm doing. And actually mental health is a really good example of where I can do that, because on the front line I get to see people coming in who haven't been able to access drug and alcohol liaison services, who are suffering with depression, anxiety, self-harm, some people even trying to take their own lives. So I think it's a real honour to be able to do both.
When we talk about mental health, though, how do you manage your own mental health when, you know, you've had a busy day, you've had case studies within your constituency, you've had to be dealing with important votes, late night votes, and then you've got weekend shifts working in busy A&Es? How does Dr. Rosanna make time for herself?
I'll be honest, it's pretty hard. And I think I'm human just like anyone else. And so I try to look for ways to sort of find a bit of space in my day. I know before we came on air, we were talking about history. I do love a good little bubble every now and then, a little dance. And we call it a bubble in South London, a bit old school there. But I do just try and take a moment for myself every day where I put the radio on, just like lose myself in the music. I also tend to, I've always been really sporty and I've taken up running. Can you believe it? I always played football and did sort of team sports and found running really boring. But I took up running in the first lockdown and kind of did sort of couch to 5K. And now I run 5K a couple of times a week when I can. And I find that really helps me clear my head, especially if I run in the rain or if I run in the park and just sort of take in the nature. I know it sounds might sound a bit bit crazy, but actually I really enjoy it. I really enjoy just being out, getting out of my own head. And I've also started meditating sometimes, nothing too long, but sometimes just the short 5-minute ones that you can find on YouTube are really important to center yourself. And I've actually really started to notice a difference between when I haven't done that for a few days and when I do it more regularly. And I personally find it helps. But I'd say for anyone listening, just do what works for you. For some people, it might be going for a walk. For some people, it might be cooking a lovely meal. I don't think I'd want to inflict my cooking on anyone. So I wouldn't be doing that myself very much. I'm not great. People wouldn't be getting much more than a couple of scrambled eggs, if I'm honest. But I think for me, exercise, music, and just going easy on myself and acknowledging if I've had a bad day, tomorrow's a new day, and start afresh from the next day.
I think I'd love to be able to run. I try running. I just can't run and I can't get going. And when I say to people, I think it'd be really good for me to be able to like pound the pavements and do a 5K, and they go, oh, that bit where it feels difficult, that's the bit that you push through. And I go, no, that's the bit where I fall over and then collapse on the floor. Like there's nothing for me to push through. I'm just shattered after about the like 4 or 5 minutes. But I'm so aware that it's something that would be really beneficial to me. But I started playing the ukulele.
That's me on a treadmill. If I'm actually watching what I'm doing on a treadmill, forget it. Game over. Like I could play football match after match after match with my team and really enjoy it. I have good fitness, but with running, I just couldn't do it until, all right, for me, the secret is get some earbuds, put the music on really, really loud and play The Prodigy. That's what works for me.
Top tip. Let me write that down. Dr. Rosanna Alencar, Prodigy, Kistery,
Prodigy,
Bubble.
Run around the park.
Prodigy Bubble. There we go. We've got this ban on amateur sports at the moment, and I know many people have been concerned about not just the physical aspect of that, but the mental health aspect, both in terms of the physicalities of it, but also the socialising that comes with it as well. Have the government got that right, do you think, with this new lockdown?
I think it's a really tough one because the government do have to be seen to be doing the right thing. And it's very difficult when they are passing legislation very quickly to sort of like discriminate between the different sports. But of course, it makes no sense to people that if you play tennis, for example, you are standing really far apart from your opponent. You are holding a tennis racket that just you are holding. You know, why can't people play golf? I do understand people's exasperation with it, but this could have been avoided if we'd actually gone into a short, sharp circuit breaker of 2 weeks, as SAGE recommended, the government's own scientific advisory group, and as the Labour Party called for. And all of this could have been a lot less painful if we'd gone into a 2-week short circuit breaker back over half term. I think it would have felt a lot less difficult. And I think not only for, you know, for adults is it difficult stopping team sports, it's also really hard for children. So many young people and children really, really rely on being able to play football with their friends. I've got two little girls. They love playing football. They're only 5 and 7, and they cannot wait for Ball and Ballers every Tuesday afternoon. That's where they see their friends. That's where they have a really good time. And stopping things like that now for at least a month, when it could have just been a couple of weeks over the half term, when it would have stopped anyway for a week, it's very difficult for many people to manage, I think.
In terms of the government's overall response and how the government is looking to guide people through this from a mental health point of view, some people would look at, you know, the £5 million financial package, the guidance. Nadine Dorries, when she came on the programme, signposted to the Every Mind Matters webpage. Is that enough?
No, it's not. And I've actually found it extremely disappointing trying to work with this government. I said right from the beginning, since I took on this post, that mental health shouldn't be a political football. I wanted to work with the government to deliver for the people that need it the most. But it has been so frustrating the way they have managed so much of the pandemic. You just have to look at test, trace and isolate. They've had almost 8 months to get on top of testing and they still haven't. They've also had a significant amount of time to get on top of the mental health of those who have been going to work to save our lives, to keep us safe. The NHS frontline, including everybody, whether they are doctors, nurses, receptionists, cleaners, porters, everyone matters, as do our care staff who've been going into care homes, going into people's homes, being the last person to see someone alive, delivering very difficult messages from families, their mental health truly, truly matters. And the government have ignored that. And I asked, even just last week, I asked Nadine Dorries 8 times if she would meet me to work cross-party on providing support for our frontline staff who keep us safe, providing support for their mental health. And she flatly refused. And quite frankly, mental health shouldn't be a political football. And I don't think the government have their eye on just how important it is to get this right. And we've got to understand that mental health delivery of services was on its knees before we even went into the pandemic. Now, as a result of everything, as a result of people feeling insecure about their jobs, their livelihoods, having to, you know, say goodbye to their loved ones in the back of an ambulance, never to see them again, being robbed of the opportunity to go to their funerals, all of these things, we have to acknowledge the real difficulty it's put on our communities, and the government need to step up and provide for them and to acknowledge this. And quite frankly, I don't think the government have been doing enough.
There's so much made about sort of data around the stats we see on our TV screens and hear on our radio every day when it comes to the physical impacts around COVID-19. I don't know about you, but the organisations that I've spoken to, they're not thinking about what does the suicide figures look like today or tomorrow. They're thinking, what will mental health issues look like in 18 months' time, in 2 years' time, in 3 years' time? That the view we have to have around the mental health impacts of COVID have to be very long term, because there'll be many people who have just scraped through the last 6, 7, 8 months and may well scrape through into the new year. It might well be next summer, post-vaccine, that we suddenly start to see that there are other mental health issues that haven't been dealt with, and we need the services there at that moment, don't we?
I could not agree with you more. And in fact, the Centre for Mental Health produced a report that said, as a result of the pandemic alone, up to 10 million people were going to be requiring support for their mental health. That's 8.5 million adults and 1.5 million children. That is a huge number of people. And you're right, there absolutely has to be a long-term approach to this. And the government have to acknowledge that there are going to be effects that go on for a significantly longer time to come. We know that there are people suffering right now with things like post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. But we also know that right now, a lot of people are running on adrenaline. They're trying to work out how to put food on the table. They're trying to go to work every day, stay strong for their families. And this is exhausting. And it often is after a prolonged period of time that it becomes too much for people. They have a chance to reflect on everything that's happened, and they start to get depression and anxiety. And it's really important that we take a super forward-looking approach to mental health.
There's many different organisations that are out there that are saying, we're ready to do the work, we've got expertise, they may well need some funding. That £5 million was put forward to be sort of dealt out by Mind, which I know was welcome, but as I understand it, it was oversubscribed by something like 10 times the amount of money that people actually required. What would a Labour government do on a day like today to say, right, we've got an issue here with mental health? What would you do? What are the figures that we're talking about? What does it look like? What are those systems that get put in place?
Well, first of all, it would be rolling out of my Care for Carers package, which I've been asking the government to meet me on, a package of comprehensive support for our frontline NHS and care staff, saying everybody matters. You need help. You need help now. It would be ready to go in place, 24-hour accessibility, manned by paid experts who can run the service and put people into a system of support with a certain number of specialist sessions designed to be tailored to exactly what they need. We would implement that immediately. But also, I think more importantly, it's about saying that the responsibility has to lie with the government. It cannot lie at the feet of the charity sector. The charity sector is supposed to be there to support the backstop. The backstop is supposed to be the government. And what we are seeing are phenomenal local charities who maybe deal in more specialist areas or in particular parts of the country that are harder to reach. We're seeing them closing down. Often they provide essential work and maybe only have a few staff, and they just can't cope. And larger organisations like Mind do incredible work, but there are hundreds and hundreds of small mental health charities who simply cannot survive. And as a Labour Party, we would prioritise them, and we would actually say that we take the responsibility of the burden of our nation's mental health on ourselves. We do not pass the buck to charities who are already under strain.
It's interesting. I was speaking just before to the CEO of Chasing the Stigma. They've created the Hub of Hope, which is this incredible database of organisations that you talked about there from right across the country. And you literally go on, you type in your postcode, and it gives you a list of the services that are close to you. And those services, they opted into the Hub of Hope so that people call and people email. They want them to contact them. But that comes from Jake, who is a suicide survivor, who suddenly thought, what help did I need? What do I wish had been there when I was in my darkest place? And when he looked around to find it nationally, it wasn't there. So he had to do it himself. And that's quite an incredible thing for people to take on. Organisations up and down the country that have had to decide themselves that they need to be there because when they needed the support, it wasn't there. Now, that's not a sustainable system, is it?
No, and people like Jake are incredible. They're turning their pain into power and they are trying to stop the very worst happening to people. And we have groups who suffer in different ways as well. We have people from BAME communities who have their own challenges. We know that if you are a young Black man, you are most likely to be diagnosed with mental ill health when you've already entered the judicial system. That is wrong. There are organisations that are set up to tackle this. We also know that if you are part of our LGBTQ plus family, you are more likely to suffer with mental ill health compared to other people. We know that if you are homeless, you have different mental health needs. And there are charities that are superbly set up to deal with different groups of people, while also understanding the intersectionality between different groups of people. And this is pretty special. And I'm hearing from charities all around the country who are being forced to close because they just cannot afford to stay open. And we cannot let them down at a time like this, and the government is letting them down.
And in terms of that, making connections with people in the right parts of the community, often people will hear about a phone line for the elderly to call. They'll hear about a local NHS service that they can call, and they'll hear about a number to call if you're a child or if you're maybe a carer. But I think most people, if they said, well, I need an ambulance now, they call 999. They'd know straight away. They wouldn't have to Google a number. They wouldn't have to look up a charity. They would know through public health campaigning in the same way, you know, to stop, look and listen and not to talk to strangers. Call 999 in an emergency, which is relevant as well in some mental health situations. But shouldn't there be one thing that we all knew? If you want to talk about your mental health, here's the number to call. It's 3 digits. Tap it into any phone. It will put you in contact with the people that you need. That would be a really simple message, wouldn't it?
Honestly, I feel like you're my brother from another mother with what you're saying. You really are. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. We need better public health signposting for support, but we need the support to be there as well when people do access it. And I think having simple messages work really, really well. And some of the simple messages I think we need to start with is to tell people that it's okay not to be okay, because often the biggest hurdle can be actually acknowledging that you've got a problem. It's not a weakness. You just need a bit of extra help to feel better. Sometimes it can be as simple as that. And being able to talk about it, being safe to talk about it, and it being open and acceptable to talk about it is really, really important. But I think, as you said so rightly, if people are in crisis, they should know where to go, but they also need to have the trust, which unfortunately they don't at the moment, that when they seek help, they're not going to be put on a 6 to 12 month waiting list they need to know that when they seek help, they're not going to be put on a 6 to 12 month waiting list in order to get the help that they need so much.
And in terms of that, when a government sets out a policy in regard to public health messaging, which comes with a spend and it comes with an upfront cost, you know, when you get 6 to 12 months down the line, 18 months down the line, and maybe people might unfortunately require further assistance or they require medication, costs start to really rack up. So is there a strong argument that says if we invested as a nation in those public health messages, that we'd actually save money for the NHS and other services down the line? And although it shouldn't always be about money, often it's the thing that governments understand. How much is it going to cost us? And actually everything we've just described there makes everything significantly cheaper. So why hasn't it happened this year? Why didn't it happen the year before? Why didn't it happen during austerity? Why didn't it happen under a Labour government. It would make sense, wouldn't it?
Not investing in mental health is a false economy, full stop. And quite frankly, I always give the example of a family with a teenager who is self-harming or has an eating disorder or has a drug addiction. If you look at how difficult it is to access services in a timely manner, it often has a knock-on effect to that young person's parents, who often give up work in order to care for their child and in order to keep their child safe while they wait for the services that they need. If this child or young person has a sibling or two siblings, it obviously affects the family dynamic. That is four or five people in a family who are unable to fulfill their potential, unable to potentially educate themselves or go to work, and fundamentally not achieving their potential when it comes to the workplace and giving back to the economy. It is an absolute false economy not to invest in that one young person that needs the help. And I think that's always a very good illustration of where we're at, particularly when we look at young people's mental health. But the same thing goes for older people. If you have a parent with dementia or some other form of mental illness, you have to ensure that they get the support that they need. And if they don't, which so often they don't at the moment in the current climate and with austerity for the last 10 years, you find that people have to give up their jobs in order to care for their loved ones. And if people are giving up their jobs to care for their loved ones, again, they're not able to contribute to taxes, contribute to the economy. So I never understand why the government don't understand this and just decide to invest more wholeheartedly in integrated health and social care systems, but to understand the importance of mental health in our whole society.
There's a government plan for the introduction of mental health provision in schools, but it's at a level that I think a lot of people think does not come quick enough and doesn't offer every single child in the country access to somebody they can speak to about their mental health. It's interesting how many people I speak to on the programme and they talk about how do they cope in certain situations. And often as a throwaway line, they think about, I think about my CBT, that's the cognitive behavioural therapy. You'll know that. But it amazes me where you think, well, if that is so helpful to so many people, then why don't we sit down with 13, 14 and 15-year-olds and go, this is what CBT is and this might help you? Because it might help them with their exams in the first instance. But actually, when they become 24 and life starts getting on top of them, or 35 when the world starts to fall down around their ears, they would at least have something that they could lean back on and go, oh, actually, there is another way of thinking about issues, which then means they can be resilient and build resilience and have resilience in themselves, which doesn't rely on anybody else. Or those other services become a, well, if you need us, absolutely, we're here. But actually, you might already have the weaponry that you require.
I would like to see talking about mental health and how to build resilience and capacity to deal with things from primary school. I really believe if we start early and tell our 5 and 6-year-olds that it's okay to feel worried, it's okay to feel scared, it's okay to feel anxious. Here's how you talk about it. Here's who you tell. There is help there for you. And then as they get a bit older, start to teach coping mechanisms with how to deal with stress and anxiety and signpost where they can go to get extra help and work with parents. Because a lot of parents want the absolute best for their children. They're not experts in mental health. They don't know what to do. But sometimes simply as telling a parent, do you know what? Maybe when your child comes home from school or before they go to bed, why don't you sit down and say to them, look, one of my worries today was this. Do you want to tell me one of your worries? Normalize talking about mental health from as young as you can, and then teach them ways in which they can A, understand that their value isn't dictated to by their exam results. I think that is a huge issue. Help and support them through the minefield that is social media. Let them know where they can go and get help if they need it, particularly if they feel they can't come to you as a parent or a teacher. Identify someone that they can go to, who they trust, and ensure that they go to them. And talk very openly about things like therapy, talking therapies, CBT, teach them what that is. And also teach them some well-being activities early on in school. I think it's really important that we teach children what they can do to kind of get out of their mind sometimes. And I know some primary schools are now talking about yoga and meditation. very, very early on in the school language. And I think that's to be welcomed.
Dr. Rosena, just a couple more, because I've taken up plenty of your time.
Don't worry, I'm enjoying it.
You mentioned carers before. I'm working on a project that's looking at young carers who have been heroic through lockdown, yeah. Particularly when you look at the impact of the COVID bill and the obligations of local councils that removed some of those care packages, removed as well with no school, the respite periods, I call it respite, but the opportunities that children had to get out of there. There's no surprise that 2/3 reported an increase in stress, 2/3 reported an increase in worries of the future, 40% said, yeah, my mental health is in a worse place. And that's on top of the responsibilities they had as well before coronavirus even struck. They, and at the same time, by the way, we don't know how many young carers there are in the country. At the moment, it's not included on the school census. So it might be 166,000, as was set out by the census in 2011. It might be 800,000 in England, as set out by a study from the University of Nottingham. But we should know, shouldn't we? We should know how many young carers are out there. And if they need support, we need to be able to find them to give them that support.
We need to know who they are, where they are, and we cannot fail them. We have to get supporting our young carers right. Because if we don't, we are curtailing their ability to fulfill their potential in their lifetime. If their whole childhood and adolescence is dictated to by often translating for their families, by taking family members to and from appointments, they're caring for them in the home. That's time that they're not studying. It's time that they're not having fun. It's time that they're not developing friendships. And all of these things, if we do not get it right for them, we are failing them for the entirety of their lives.
I appreciate that. And I'm sure if you follow the hashtag Young Carers Count, you'll see that there are plenty of people up and down the country who agree with you too. And another sort of section of society flagged up from a mental health point of view are those on the autism spectrum. Because, yeah, of course, if you view the world in a particular way and people around you try and help you shape the world in a particular way, to then tear up that rule book and say none of the rules apply anymore, or they do for a bit and then they don't again, must be incredibly difficult for those on the spectrum, but also those who are within the families who are trying to manage those situations as well. And that may well be, once again, an issue that we're going to have to come back to.
When I was at university, I worked with a charity called Children with Autism, and I know that there are people doing incredible work in this sector. And the challenges that young people with autism, children with autism and their families have faced during this outbreak have been unprecedented. We know that routine is key for these young people, and it has been incredibly hard. And I wish the government had had more of a focus on understanding some of the nuances and some of the groups that need help and support right now. And I think the one size fits all model doesn't always work. And this is one group in which we really needed to look at ways in which we could adapt to support them, keep as much of a routine as possible through ever-changing times, if that makes sense.
absolutely. Dr. Rosena, let's give some marks out of 10 for the government's response from a mental health point of view at the moment. Let's do it as a school report, if you like. What have they got right so far, and what do they need to make changes on and improve instantly?
I have to preface this a little bit, because I don't ever like to use mental health or see mental health as a political football, but I have to call out wrong when I see it. And the fact that in the first 3 months of lockdown, the health secretary didn't meet with a single mental health organisation or trust says everything about how they prioritise mental health. And it wasn't until I kept putting in the freedom of information requests and pushing that they even started to have the meetings. So it is 0 out of 10 on that for me, nil pois. Also, the opportunities to meet and work cross-party. I mean, I've lost count of the number of times I've asked Nadine Dorries to meet with me to support our carers and frontline NHS workers, mental health. And the refusal to meet is just staggering. So I find it very difficult to say what has been done well with regards to mental health. And that is really something coming from me, because I'm not someone that likes to try and score political points. But I think the track record in this says it all. And it was just last week that I stood at the dispatch box, very kindly, very nicely said, will the minister meet with me to work cross-party together? And the flat refusal just was so disappointing. I was a bit lost for words.
And what would that conversation look like, do you think? How would that go? If you were removing the political element from it and you could sit down in front of Nadine Dorris, what would be the opening gambit? What would be those suggestions that you would make that the government could implement today?
Well, they talk about a health line that they have, which isn't 24 hours a day, which isn't very well accessed. So I would say, I understand that you have a part-time helpline that is manned by volunteers who might not necessarily be expert, but even if they are, that's great, thank you. But there's something going wrong if it's not being accessed anywhere close to the number of people that we know are suffering with their mental health. So is there something we can do to promote a helpline more? I would say to Nadine, it would be really great if you would adopt the 24-hour model, because with shift workers, and I know better than anyone what it's like to finish a shift at 1 a.m. and come home, you know, with shift workers and mental health, they can need to pick up the phone any time of the day or the night. So I would immediately say, can we make it 24 hours? And then we would dig into other elements of the package of support, because I think everyone matters. And I think carers should be able to access the support. I think cleaners should be able to access the support if they've worked in hospitals. We know that so many of them were asked to go in and clean rooms without PPE where someone had died of COVID, then risking taking COVID home to their own families. And many of them did. So I'd say, can we include everybody in this package, please? And we would just have a conversation. And if there are elements that she wouldn't be keen on, I'd have a better understanding of that rather than a flat refusal to meet, because generally that indicates that somebody either has something to hide or absolutely no will to do the very thing that you're asking them to do to help others. And her response to me, which was, if I want to inform policy, like the Labour Party need to try harder at the next election to get elected, that just felt somewhat childish.
I will do my best for next time Liverpool have got football matches where you can actually sit in the stadium to try maybe get you a couple of seats next to each other. So for at least 90 minutes, you will be forced to have those conversations, if at all possible. Dr. Rosanna, thank you so much for your time.
The offer still stands. The offer still stands, Nadine. If you're listening to Mental Health Monday and you're up for meeting, we'll get a coffee. We'll sit socially distanced and we'll have a chat.
Will you come up to Liverpool and meet some of the wonderful organisations that I've spent the last many years speaking to? Because I think plenty of them want to make sure that they've got the ear of politicians who empathise and sympathise with the situation they find themselves. The work that they've done is absolutely world-class as well, and we'll continue to share that as well. Thank you for your thoughts as well on the young carers. Really appreciate that. And I'm going to forward on your thoughts on our radio station Kistory onto the bosses there, who will be delighted. You might make some industry news on in that regard as well. But thank you for your time, Dr. Rosanna Allen-Khan. I really appreciate you joining us on this week's Mental Health Monday.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute honour and a pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.